Thank you, Tripti. I'm the odd guy here. First of all, I'm a plant pathologist. Secondly, if you notice, I have the longest title. And the third, I'm going to talk about tomatoes here. So it's going to be a little different, but I'm just going to give a brief overview of what I've done with my colleagues. And I'm not going to repeat the title here. You'll read it. It's pretty long. But Amanda Strayer, the person in bold, is a PhD student with me. She completed her master's, and part of this is her work. Jeff Jones is a bacteriologist at Gainesville. Ismail Oksoy was a PhD student in chemistry in Wei Hong Tan's lab in University of Florida, completed, now an assistant professor in Turkey. Wei Hong Tan, Steve Olson, most of you may know, vegetable specialist at University of Florida, retired now. Josh Freeman replaced his position. Gary Willard, plant pathologist, Gulf Coast Research Center. Aaron Palmetier is an ornamental pathologist at Homestead. Why he's here, because I'm going to talk briefly about roses. Gary Knox, environmental horticulturist, many of you may know. Laura Ritchie is a bioscientist with me. Deborah Navarrete have worked with us in collaboration to develop one of the nanomaterials. Funding came from Florida Tomato Committee, University of Florida Dean's office on these projects. So just to give a brief idea for you who may not know about bacterial spot on tomatoes, it is one of the top, if not the most important bacterial disease on tomatoes in Florida, other subtropical places, and tropical places in the world. It can cause severe yield losses. There are four different species of bacterial associated with Pseudomonas that can cause this disease. But in Florida, the predominant one is Pseudomonas perforans. And there are two races of it, race T3 and T4, which is predominant. The characteristic symptoms is blighting of the leaves, as you see here. Now, the first symptom would be short hole-like appearance of the leaves. It starts with lesions, small lesions, the center cracks, and there will be yellow margins around the lesions. The key part here is that's why the name is called Pseudomonas perforans, because it creates a short hole-like appearance. Fruit lesions, very common, especially if the infection is early in the season, you can see severe fruit lesions which can cause 50% or more of unmarketable fruits in case of tomatoes. Now, this is a field with a severe bacterial spot infection. Some of you may be familiar who have seen tomato fields, severe blighting way up, and it becomes really difficult to get a good harvest, a marketable harvest from these plots. And it can cost greater than 50% in big commercial settings. In field trials, it's difficult to do that. And this is consistent with most of the trials that we all do to demonstrate that yield impact on whatever we are testing. That is because of the small scale at which we are doing these trials. Now, if you were to just, Ed just mentioned about some of the interesting work he's doing on antibiotics with his team. And I just want to briefly mention about the story here. The story is a little different here. And the story historically is very relevant, because you think about 1950s, there was a great influx of antibiotics into industry for bacterial disease management. And this has been a turning point. It worked really well for a long time till most of the strains developed resistance to these antibiotics. 1960s onwards, or well before, copper came into existence as the magic bactericide. This is, even still, it is a magic bactericide for most. But think about the amount of copper that goes in the environment. It is unbelievable. And toxicity, a lot of issues. Now, does copper work anymore? Sorry, no. Almost all the strains that we have isolated from tomatoes in Florida are resistant to copper. Well, let me turn the word. Not resistant, tolerant. Most people don't like to use the word resistant. But you can improve the efficacy of copper bactericides by using copper with an ethylene bisdithiocarbamate materials like Mangosep or MAN. So that's the current grower standard. How many of you know about bacteriophages? A good number. It works great. The only limitation is that it works great only under good environmental conditions. Very early in the day, late in the day, application, cloudy weather, it works well. It is highly UV sensitive. It doesn't work very well under those conditions. So if you were to go to Florida and ask a tomato grower, does bacteriophages work? They would say, it worked last year really well, but it didn't work this year. It didn't work next, it may not work next year. So it is very inconsistent. Now, there are many biological control materials out there. Some of the prominent ones include Streptomyces lyticus, Bacillus subtilis species. Works very well under ideal environmental conditions again. We have looked closely into rotating that with many other compounds, and it works at certain times, but not a consistent response. One material that is holding up decently well is an SAR inducer, which is a systemic acquired resistance which triggers plants' defense response against bacteria. Acibenzolar, S-methyl, is one of those materials. The available trade name is Actigard. And that is one material that could be used effectively against bacterial spot and the only potential alternative currently to copper mangosup. But again, every grower doesn't use it simply because at high rates or if the rates are not done well, it could cause yield-related issues because there could be overexpression of defense-related genes. So that is the key criteria by which we decided we need to look at it more closely and try to see what could be novel approaches that we could bring in. I'm going to try to take you through this busy cartoon here. One of the first things that I looked at was titanium dioxide. How many of you have heard about titanium dioxide before? Okay, some of you. Can you tell me an instance or a place where titanium dioxide is used? Yeah. Sunscreen. Toothpaste is white because it's titanium dioxide in it. Your medications is white because it's titanium dioxide. A lot of food material that you consume day to day includes titanium dioxide. If you check the package of sugar, sometimes there's an addition of titanium dioxide. Paint is white because it's titanium dioxide. The key thing is that it's an approved EPA material used for food. It can be easily used in food, at least as of now. No known toxicity. There are some studies out there, but not a lot. So that is one of the first steps we took. Let's look at titanium dioxide as a potential material. Then why should we take titanium dioxide? Titanium dioxide have a property called photocatalysis. That means the material have the ability to take upon light. When light falls on titanium dioxide, it can produce superoxide anions and hydroxyl radicals. It's a very interesting phenomenon. And once that produces, it works as an antimicrobial material. But there is a problem. It is a very small process. It is not a very active process. So one of the things that in 1972 to 1980, a Japanese group did some exceptional work where they kind of created a nano-based titanium dioxide. Now, what is nano? If I were to tell you one single thing about nanotechnology, I don't have the time to go in depth, that would be the tremendously increased surface-to-mass area. And that is an incredible thing because the effectiveness of some materials can be improved by changing it from the bulk form to the nano form. So what the Japanese group found is that when they changed regular titanium dioxide into its nano form, there would be a tremendous increase in superoxide anions and hydroxyl radicals. So just to briefly mention what happens is that the activation of photocatalysis for titanium dioxide happens at 388 nanometers. So basically, it's under UV. But UV light is not, even though it's available, it's not available in plenty in nature. So we have to change into visible light. So one of the ways they did it is that they would add a compound into the titanium dioxide structure, which is known as dopant. It could be metals like zinc or silver or other materials, which would shift the ability of the absorbance from 388 nanometers towards 400 to 450 nanometers, which is a visible range. So in case of titanium dioxide, when light falls on the molecule, there's a shift in energy from valence band to the conduction band, and it produces a free electron, as you see above, and it would also produce electron hole, as indicated above. The electron hole would move to the surface of the crystal, and when oxygen is present, it would change it into superoxide anions, as you would see to the top right, and to the top, at the lower bottom, it would interact with water molecules, converting them into hydroxyl radicals. Now, if you know, superoxide and hydroxyl radicals are extremely toxic. It can kill bacterial cells or other pathogens very easily. So that is the concept by which we started working on. Let me take you through a complex graph here. Okay, don't get lost. If you get lost, raise your hand. Your x-axis are the different treatments we had. On the y-axis, we have the bacterial population enumerated. So as a plant pathologist, let me try to explain this to the crowd here. So basically what I'm doing here is that coating these nanomaterials onto glass slides, okay? And once it is dried, I would put a certain amount of bacteria, Pseudomonas perfringens, a strain that is resistant to copper, tolerant to copper, on these glass slides. And I would expose these glass slides onto light. So light would be basically put on it 3 × 10⁴ lux. Different durations, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes. Now, you're trying to prove the concept of photocatalysis. So the first thing, what do you need as control? dark, right? Because you want to prove that it doesn't work in the absence of light. So we have non-illuminated control to the far right. That's the blue bar, okay? We had various type of materials. We had titanium dioxide, titanium dioxide doped with silver, titanium dioxide doped with zinc. We have non-coated material, glass slides, to see whether that has any effect. And also we had non-illuminated controls where all coatings were done and the samples were kept in dark. And then we took the bacteria, washed these glass slides, took the bacteria out, enumerated them, and this is what we found. At starting 10 minutes, there's an incredible loss in bacterial population. Basically, bacteria get killed dramatically in the presence of these photocatalytic compounds on the glass slides. So titanium dioxide silver and titanium dioxide zinc, you can see that pattern right here. And if you look at 15 minutes, the pattern increases, and without the dope and also, the titanium dioxide starts to fall down. So basically, it proves the concept of photocatalysis very easily. Now the second question was, how much light intensity was required? So we had three different light intensities, 3 times 10 to the 4, 10 to the 3, and 10 to the 2. And we exposed bacteria under these conditions. And we had non-illuminated control. Sorry, going back to the previous slide, there was no effect of the when the materials were kept in dark, there was no activity at all. And that is true in this slide also. But as you see, 10 to the 4 was the optimum level to kill all the bacterial cells within 15 minutes. At the 10 to the 3, it also worked for dope and with the dope and titanium dioxide silver and titanium dioxide zinc. Okay, so we are on a good go on our conceptual model to work further on this. So we did experiments on greenhouse setting on naturally infected plants. We had some transplants that were naturally infected. These plants were treated with these materials, titanium dioxide doped with silver, and titanium dioxide doped with zinc. We had the non-treated. The gray bar represents the pre-treatment number of lesions per plant. The black bar represents the post-treatment lesions per plant. And as you would see here, all of these treatments significantly reduced the number of bacterial spot lesions on these plants. And this was repeated, and this is a comparing data set on those experiments. Now, the next step was to get this to the field level. A lot of the times, nanomaterials, it's available in small quantities, but we had this producer who would give us in bulk, and that's where we started this experimentation. We did the study in fall 2010. I would like to note that this was natural inoculant. We are not inoculating these fields. We are relying on natural infection of the pathogen in the field. Towards your far right, you would see a column AUDPC, which means Area Under Disease Progress Curve. That represents the cumulative amount of disease over a period of time. Higher the value for AUDPC, higher the disease. So just keep a note of that. And we have the yield data based upon the USDA standards here. We had different dilutions of the titanium dioxide zinc material because that was the only material that we had an availability in bulk to use. When I talk about 1:10 dilution, I'm talking about roughly 500 parts per million to 800 parts per million of the material, just so that you know. Copper was used as a control, copper by itself. Copper with mangosub was used as a control because that's a grower standard. We had an untreated plots also. So if you look in this table, to the far right, you would see that titanium dioxide zinc at 1:10 had an AUDPC value which was significantly lower than the untreated and the copper mangosub as well as copper by itself, which demonstrates its ability in reducing bacterial spot disease severity over a period of time. There was no yield impact in the study, but that is pretty consistent with most of the trials that everyone does in Florida because it is hard to show the yield impact in small-scale trials. But there is some trend of increasing yield, at least in this trial. 1:20 and 1:40 also had good effect in reducing bacterial spot in this trial. We had a trial in spring 2011, natural inoculum again. We could not harvest it because of hail damage. But if you look at the disease severity with the AUDPC ranking, copper mangosub 643, cocide was higher, and which indicates the presence of copper tolerant strains in the field, even in the presence of natural inoculum level. And titanium dioxide zinc at 1:10 and 1:20 and 1:40 had a significantly lower disease severity compared to the untreated. And 1:10 had significantly lower disease compared to cocide and both the cocide treatments. Sorry, just the cocide treatment in this trial. We had the trial in fall 2011 at Waimama, Florida, at Gulf Coast Research Center. We did not find any difference in disease severity in any of the treatments, including titanium dioxide, zinc, copper, mangosep, untreated. There was no impact on yield in this trial. With the trial, at one point I would mention that was a trial done with artificial inoculation. The fields were inoculated with the bacteria in this case. Going back to Quincy, we had a trial in fall 2011, natural inoculum again, and as you would see, copper mangosep worked really well, untreated the worst in managing the bacterial disease severity. Titanium dioxide zinc was comparable to copper mangosep at 995 AUDPC value. There was no yield impact, as I mentioned before, but you can see that trend in this material. Now, is it all sweet? No. Three out of the four trials conducted during this time had some phytotoxicity starting from the sixth spray. Remember, this is a photocatalytic material, so it can also break down organic matter very easily. So when you apply to the plants more and more, there is a high likelihood of risk of phytotoxicity. So we saw some phytotoxicity starting from 6 to 8 spray. But titanium dioxide at 1:10 dilution worked really well and was comparable to the grower standard in all of the treatments. There was no reduction in yield, that's all I could say, because I couldn't tell there was an increase in yield just because of the nature of how we do the trials. But there was no reduction in yield because of the application of the material. We have tested macro-scale titanium dioxide, not in this trial, separately. And there's some marginal effect, but very low than titanium dioxide zinc dopant. Now, with the issues noted, we think that it may be due to the materials falling on leaves and it's not washing off, and more materials creating an excessive photocatalytic effect on certain sections of the leaf, and that may be the reason of phytotoxicity. Now, one of the things I mentioned, it only works in the presence of light. Now, bacteria, does bacteria even care whether it's, they go and infect the plants day and night, right? So you have to have some materials in the mixture that would be activated in the presence of the light. Yes, silver can, but the amount of silver in a mixture of, let's say, 10,000 parts per million of titanium dioxide as a dopant is just 25 parts per million. So when you dilute it, it's so low that there is no activity at all. But we are working in this area, trying to see whether we could manipulate the TiO2 dopant mixture so that there's one material in it that would work in the dark also. Now, I'm not going to take you through the data on this one. Now, we have done trials on a new bacterial disease on roses caused by Sandomonas species in three locations, at Monrovia nurseries in Cairo, Georgia, Quincy, and in Homestead, and we've seen excellent effect of the material against this disease. One of the four trials had some phytotoxicity, but all the other trials worked really well. Now, shifting gears here to another project that I am doing. It's a complex graph here, but let me basically try to give you a gist of it. In this kind of formulation, what we did is that Wei Hong Tan from the Department of Chemistry, he's a distinguished professor in the Department of Chemistry at the University of Florida, and what he did is that working with us, he created a material which is based on graphene oxide. Now, graphene oxide, you may know that the lead in the pencil is graphene. And the graphene, basically it's a lot of carbon, and they come in sheets, graphene oxide sheets. So double-stranded DNA, synthesized DNA, was deposited onto these graphene sheets to get a nice pattern. Now why? One of the major problems of nanoparticles is agglomeration. So once you suspend the nanoparticles for field applications in water, they all tend to come together. So there had to be a process by which nanoparticles can still stay separate and will be as much effective as it would be in experimental settings. So the way they designed is that they had a double-stranded DNA in it, silver was put into it. To figure out whether silver was bound very effectively, they put an FITC dye on it just to look at the fluorescence. And when the fluorescence was quenched, it would prove that it bound very well to the graphene oxide matrix. I don't know the complete chemistry behind that quenching process, but that's how you actually demonstrate that it's actually well laid out in this matrix. Now, I want to show you two graphs here. The top graph, we tested this material on a copper-tolerant strain isolated from tomatoes in Florida. The bottom graph is from a copper-sensitive strain isolated from tomatoes in Florida. We had four different data points at 15 minutes, 1 hour, 4, and 24 hours, as you see from left to right of each point. We had three different concentrations. We had copper equivalents of 50 microgram, 25 microgram, and 10 microgram. And also we had 50 microgram of that matrix of silver double-stranded DNA graphene oxide, at the three rates, and we had non-treated tubes. Now, this is an in vitro experiment to first figure out whether this would work. Now, I should also tell you one more thing, which is very interesting, is that if you were to take 100 ppm of silver double-stranded DNA graphene oxide structure, the amount of silver in there is just 18 ppm. So it's pretty low in that big structure. So as expected, you see here, in a copper-tolerant strain, this is the amount of bacteria in the tube. In a copper-tolerant strain, copper is not working. But if you were to use silver double-stranded DNA, it even works at 10 microgram per ml, and the amount of silver in that matrix is probably just less than 2 microgram. So the basic concept here is that you are modifying silver to work at extremely low rates. Now, this is the case in case you're using a copper-sensitive strain, and even in that case, it worked really well. Now, we did three greenhouse experiments. This is not yet up to the level of field-level experiments, and there's a limitation to doing field-level experiments. I'll talk about that. We had AUDPC on the y-axis, which indicates to the disease severity. X-axis are the different treatments. We had three rates of the silver double-stranded DNA graphene oxide. We have copper mangosteb as a control and untreated as a control. And the plants were treated with the material followed by inoculation and bagging and looking at the disease severity over a period of time. The trend is same in all the three experiments. The material works really well at 100 or lower, 75 microgram per ml. It works it significantly reduces the disease severity compared to copper mangosteb and untreated. So this is a very good finding as an ideal system to potentially use in transplant system, not in commercial systems because synthesizing DNA, it would be costly. So we're looking at potentially modifying it from a double-stranded DNA to some other matrix that would help us to reduce the cost here. Just look at the picture. On the top left, A, silver as it is. B, it is graphene oxide sheets. You can change the size depending upon the duration of sonication. To the C, you are seeing silver embedded on graphene with double-stranded DNA. Now, if there was no double-stranded DNA in that mixture, they all would be clumped like that. And that is the most important aspect. And the activity, antimicrobial activity, dramatically increases. Bottom A, Santamonas perforans cells with an SEM. B, cells that have been affected by the process. And C also, same. This is how the deposition on leaves look like. A is 500 microgram per ml, 2 hours after treatment. You know, this is carbon, so you can see it there. 200 microgram per ml, 2 hours after treatment for B. C is 100 microgram. There was some phytotoxicity observed at 500 microgram and 200 microgram, which is shown in the bottom pictures. We didn't see any phytotoxicity with 100 microgram per ml. Now, finishing with the last slide, we have other projects also going on in this area, and we are looking at many metal oxides against bacterial spot of tomato, and we are also looking at metal oxides on fusarium wilt and phytophthora blight or fruit rot of watermelon, funded by the National Watermelon Association. We're also looking at many advanced copper nanoparticles, working with Dr. Sudesh Mukul Center at University of Central Florida. Some of you may have seen some of the data that he and Dr. Jim Graham is working on citrus canker at a recent meeting. So we are working with the same group looking at the bacterial spot tomato picture. But one of the most important things that we are interested is the fate of particles. You know, there's a big question about where does the particles go? How long does it stay in nanoform? Does it even affect? So we are possibly going to do some research on looking at impact compared to bulk materials on the fate of these particles. And these are the three students and Wade Elmer from Connecticut Ag Experiment Station is working on that. And this is my lab team. It's even though there's just two or three people, everyone contributes to discussions and collaborations. Just want to highlight and thank all of them. Thank you. Yes.
Yes. So I assume at least that the infection for the leaf surface.
Mm-hmm.
How would you expect any of this technology to be applicable to a flowing
Good question. So I knew you were going to ask that question, or someone was going to ask this question. So titanium dioxide, obviously, you cannot have it inside. It needs light, right? Unless we have a dopant that would work the other way, you could. But again, that would be inefficient system. So titanium dioxide in soil is not going to do any photocatalytic process. So forget that material. We cannot use that. But silver double-stranded DNA, graphene oxide, potentially, yes. But I already know that there are certain people working in that area, similar silver materials attached to natural compounds and to be injected so that it would move through the phloem system. There's already work going on in that area, but that material could potentially be used. Yes?
What are the regulatory considerations?
For titanium dioxide or the silver?
For both.
For titanium dioxide, zinc, there is no regulatory concerns because TiO2 is already an approved food material. Zinc is one of the safer materials that EPA would approve generally. And so from other than the nano form, which is not necessarily under regulation yet, it may come pretty soon. As of now, there is no regulatory issues right now. More than that is trying to work around that phyto toxicity. That's what we are dealing with. In case of silver, there could potentially be regulatory issues because silver could be more toxic to other systems, aquatic systems and all. So, but what we are pushing this from the goal and from the experimental evidence that the amount of silver that is being used in this matrix is incredibly low. So there could still be issues, but that is the way that we are going into to see whether EPA would accept that. But we are not yet into that kind of looking at a registration phase yet, because it's purely fundamental at this time.
Did I understand that the free radical generation does not happen in titanium dioxide unless you make it into a nanoparticle?
It happens in bulk form, but it is very, the process is not very active. It happens, but it's very little. But
so
when
you...
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want to get the nanoparticles on your skin.
You know, you'd be surprised to know there's nano everywhere. Most people don't disclose it under chemistry, with studies and materials that come out in the market. If you were to take it and look it carefully, many of these materials are already in nano form. Yeah, I cannot talk more about it, but it's out there. And also you think about many natural materials in nature, like nano clay. They are naturally nano in form. A lot of particles and dust particles tend to be in nano. Volcanic ash, naturally nano. So are we exposed to nanomaterials in general, other than without industries putting it out? Yes.
Are those free radical generators?
No, they are not free radical generators, at least that we know of. Yeah. No, we haven't, but there's a easy way that we thought we could do it, but we haven't done that. Right. There's actually if there's time. Or I could be here.
So we have the citrus working group meetings from 3:15 to 3:45, but if you are interested, we can carry on with the discussion.
Yeah, but just to answer your question on that, We are looking into, there are other materials, there's a black titanium dioxide which was recently discovered by a Chinese group. It's quite amazing. That have 100 times the photocatalytic activity of the regular white titanium dioxide. The goal for chemists and engineers and material scientists is to improve the photocatalytic activity. In my case, I'm trying to bring it down because I don't want too much activity. So it's a fine line.
Thank you.